We kick it off, though, this afternoon by welcoming to the program a talented actor, broadcaster, podcast host who stars in a wonderful new movie called Love and Taxes. We're joined by Jake Reiner. Jake, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Rich. I was hoping you'd have me on for the 3,211th episode, so this is an honor.
Well, you know, we've been holding out for a while until we got to that point, but I said, yeah, what's the Jake Reiner number? 3211, no question.
Oh, of course. Everyone knows that.
We did have, by the way, I was looking back, it was in 2017, we had your grandfather on the show, and absolutely one of the highlights of my time doing this, and what an incredibly gracious and kind man he was.
Yes, he was that way on the air and off the air as a family man. What you saw is what you got with him, and I'm happy that you got a chance to interview him.
Yeah, he had just done the Today Show where he was demonstrating the workout that he did in bed in the morning, and I said, yeah. I have to tell you, that's a pretty strenuous workout, and I don't know if I could handle that. And he said, Rich, when a 96-year-old man tells you to do something, you do it.
Exactly. He could lift his leg like a rocket. He was very, very limber up until the end.
Well, I want to talk about this wonderful movie of yours, Love and Taxes. I had a chance to check it out over the weekend, and it was just terrific. Funny, but also brilliant in the way it's structured, too. And without giving too much away, I thought I knew what was happening, and then I got lured in to the story of these two, Donald, a hope-to-be CPA, who eventually becomes one, and Belinda, who has an agenda of her own. It is such a wonderful story.
Yeah, it really is. And you really get to see the journey of these two characters because they're pretty much the only two characters in the entire film. And it was originally written as a play by Lloyd Schwartz, and he had the idea of wanting to turn it into a movie, but he wanted to do it in a very specific way, which is we do each scene as one take. And there are, I don't know if you counted, Rich, there are only 7 scenes in the whole movie. And each scene is about 20 to 30 pages long. So you can imagine how long these scenes actually are. And the fact that both me and Alexis Abrams, who played Belinda, had to memorize all these lines and not mess up once. Because if you do, you have to go back to the beginning and restart the whole take. Not only that, we had one camera and a boom mic operator that we had to operate and dance around. And there were a lot of instances where there would be a boom shadow on my face, or the camera would bump into the wall, or I would forget where I am, and we'd forget a line, and we have to go all the way back to the beginning. So it was an artistic achievement that I'd never really ever considered doing in my entire life, never thought that I could ever pull it off, and we did it. And that to me is honestly the biggest pull for why people should want to watch this movie.
Now, Lloyd Schwartz, am I right that he's the son of Sherwood Schwartz?
Yes, he is. Of the Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island fame.
That's fantastic. Well, it's great. You and Alexis have such tremendous chemistry together, and that's obviously that has to happen or this whole thing doesn't work, but you guys are great together.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it was a really long process, thousands and thousands of submissions we hear, and it all got brought down to the final four. You know, we're in the March Madness world right now, so I guess that's an appropriate term to use, where it was me and another person going up for Donald and Alexis and another actress going up for Belinda. They brought us to this little studio in L.A. where they brought in, you know, the directors and the producers and the writers of the movie. And we basically had to audition in front of all of these people. And then they made their decision. And I felt that I had more chemistry with Alexis than anyone else that we auditioned with. And Ken Feinberg, who co-directed this movie, called me and said, who did you have more chemistry with? And I told him that it was Alexis. And Alexis had told Ken that she had the most chemistry with me, so it kind of just worked out seamlessly, and then we worked really well together pretty much throughout the whole process.
And did I read along the way that you shot the whole thing in 3 days?
3 days,
wow.
Rich. 3 days, and I'll tell you why. So this was shot during the summer last year, and if you remember, there was a big strike going on with the actors and writers, and there were a select few projects that were SAG after approved that could go and continue production. if they met a certain criterion, our film was under the SAG micro-budget agreement. So we were able to shoot this movie, but the constraint was is that we had to do it in a very small amount of time. We flew to Atlanta in July. We spent a total of a week there, week plus there. And because there were only seven scenes in the whole movie, you could shoot two scenes a day and call it a day. And that is what Ken Feinberg and Craig Tallis, who's the other director, that's what they decided to do. Let's see how efficient we can shoot this movie. And so we only took 3 days to shoot seven scenes. And it was an undertaking like no other. You add to the fact that it was in Atlanta in the middle of summer, just oven heat of epic proportions.
And wearing those heavy 70s clothes, too.
Oh, my God, Rich. I mean, I was born in the 90s, so I don't know what that was like to go to work every day wearing that kind of attire. But I never, ever would envy that of anybody, because those thick 70s suits were very unforgiving. You couple that with the heat in Atlanta, the fact that you have to kill the air conditioning before you start shooting.
Right.
And you add to the fact that I just sweat profusely anyway. I was dying. And you can see me in a few of the takes through the movie just wiping sweat away from my forehead because it was getting into my eyes. And to be able to
see, I thought that was acting. That was acting, Jake. I thought, no, Donald's nervous. He's going to get caught.
Exactly. Well, I was nervous about remembering my line. So it kind of played. So I'm glad that it played for you, Rich. But like all of those factors at play to be able to concentrate and memorize all these lines and get through the scene was an undertaking, like I said, I've never done before. But we were able to pull it off. And I was so proud of that.
Well, and it must have been in some ways like doing a play.
It was. It really was. It was like filming a play. But Lloyd, who didn't want it to look like a play, wanted it to look more like a movie than a play. We added these dream sequences too. So where, you know, Belinda is kind of talking about, you know, how she, you know, fell in love with various characters. I'm not going to go into any of the details about that, but we basically used, you know, the one office set and built a dream sequence portion of it so that when the camera panned by one of the windows, that was the dream sequence. That was Belinda's diner that she works at, that she's a waitress at. So it was a really cool way to kind of change from scene to scene because there are no cuts throughout the whole scene. So you have to move from the inner office to the lobby to the dream sequence and then back into the inner office. It was kind of a real choreographed dance.
Well, the structure of the film was so terrific. I love the costumes were great. Having grown up in the 70s and remembering polyester so well, that was fabulous. The photographs that you used to set up the transition between each scene were wonderful. And the music, whoever was responsible for picking the music, that was a great part of it too. But what was terrific to see is, and again, I didn't expect it early on. I thought, hey, it's comedy. It's a light comedy. It's going to be fun. But there was so much character development over the course of these seven scenes.
Right, exactly. And you really see the journey that both of them take with those transitions, because we had to move the plot along. Each scene is 1 year later. So you kind of get to see how, you know, Donald's personal life unravels in, you know, over the course of a few years. Also, Belinda's timeline, how her backstory unravels over time. And the idea that these two people obviously have this this insane connection with one another, they're never quite on the same timeline. They're always missing each other. There's always some factor that gets in the way of them lining up. And the struggle of that is so relatable to today, because you could have, you know, a huge crush on someone and they could have a huge crush on you, but the timing of it just may never work out. And sometimes it never works out and you're going to have to deal with that. But in this instance, you see where it is able to work and where it isn't. And just the two characters kind of always missing each other just kind of keeps it interesting throughout.
Some great lines in it, too. One, early on in the film, I wrote it down. It was so good. I think I want to put this on a business card. where she says to you, you're ethical to a point, that's worthy of some consideration.
Right, exactly. No, that's just the satirical, the dry sense of humor that Lloyd has. And we actually have a lot more in common than we realized going into it. Obviously, our family's background, our, you know, sort of Hollywood legacy background, you've got that. You've got the fact that both of us are huge Dodgers fans. We're diehard Dodgers fans. And then the kicker for me, which was the weirdest thing, is that the two of us have the exact same birthday.
Wow.
We're both born on May 2nd, which I mean, just the stars align for this project in a lot of ways. And I just love the way Lloyd writes, because it's very my style of comedy. I have a dry sense of humor. I have sort of the quick wit reports a lot to what people say. And the way he wrote was just kind of perfect how I normally would talk.
Well, it's laugh out loud funny, but it's also sweet. It's poignant. It really is a terrific film. So now what's happening here? Are you, I know you're applying to festivals. Is that the next step?
That's right. We have applied to a number of different festivals, and we have the honor of showing up at two of them now. One of them is Myrtle Beach in South Carolina. That's coming up on April 26th. And then the other one here in LA is the Beverly Hills Film Festival, May 3rd. So those are our kind of coming out party, our debut for this film. And we're hoping that, you know, from that, we can get a distribution partner and sell this movie, but also maybe gain traction and get into other festivals as well.
We're talking with Jake Reiner. The new film is called Love and Taxes. I wanted to talk a little bit about you and your background. You went to Syracuse, the cradle of sportscasters. I know you're a Vin Scully guy. Did you think that maybe that's what you wanted to do, become the next Scully, the next Bob Costas?
That's exactly what I wanted to do. And they call Syracuse Sportscaster U for a reason. There's a lot of great alumni that have come from it, Bob Costas being one of them. I did want to become the next Vin Scully. I knew that I was a decent ball player, but not good enough to do anything beyond, you know, playing in high school. So I thought the next best thing would be to call baseball games. And that's kind of what my original thought was when I got into Syracuse. But then while I was there, I kind of developed a passion for news broadcasting, which was kind of interesting. And talking to some of my professors there, they were sort of saying, you know, every, you know, guy wants to go into sports broadcasting. But if you can carve out a nice little career for yourself in news, you can kind of climb the ladder a little bit faster and get to a larger market in a shorter amount of time, which is exactly what happened. I developed this passion for news, and I kind of went on this sort of three-stop tour, beginning in Salinas, Monterey, Central Coast, California, which is a gorgeous place to start. Then I jumped pretty significant market size up to Houston, which is top 10 in Houston, Texas. And then I came back home and got to work for my hometown station, KCAL KCBS. And total time of doing this job was about 10 years. So I had a great experience being a broadcast journalist. I reported, I anchored, I covered sports, I covered news. I got to have the best of both worlds, because as a news reporter that knows a lot about sports, you get those assignments all the time. You get the Super Bowls and the Final Fours and the World Series, because they need news reporters to cover those things. And I had a unique set of, you know, knowledge and skills when it comes to that. So I kind of was the perfect candidate. And that's what I tell, you know, sort of young people that are coming up through the business that are going into broadcast news that want to do sports and maybe aren't getting the traction they need. There are other routes.
Yeah, and you got the chance to do both. You started your baseball podcast talking about the Dodgers. Is that still going?
Oh, yeah. That's something that I joined during the pandemic because I had taken a year off from doing news, kind of trying to figure out what the heck was going on in the world. So I felt like erring on the side of caution was probably the best decision for me. And I joined these guys, Kevin Klein, David Rosenthal. They're my two co-hosts on the Incline Dodgers podcast. We're a fan-driven Dodgers podcast, but all three of us are very, very knowledgeable baseball fans and just insane Dodgers fans. We watch all the games. We hang out together. We know all the stats, and we know all the trends, and we follow the team really well. And so you really get a great kind of comprehensive look at the team, as opposed to just having fans that love the game and watch the game that don't really follow it as intently as we do. And so I feel like our podcast really gives the real like nitty gritty stuff for Dodgers fans that really want to dive deep into, you know, who their, you know, long reliever is coming out of the bullpen and how, you know, give him some time, because when August rolls around, that's when he really kicks into gear. I mean, those kinds of insights that we provide. So the Incline Dodgers podcast has been a really fun ride. We've gained a lot of fans over the years and continue to do that on a weekly basis. And it's just been a ton of fun as a diehard Dodgers fan and baseball fan.
How much of that love of baseball came from your family?
All of it, literally all of it. My grandfather was a huge baseball fan growing up. He was he grew up in New York. My dad grew up in New York. They were both New York Giants fans, the New York baseball Giants, before they moved to San Francisco. That was their team. My dad grew up loving Willie Mays. And so, but they both became Dodgers fans for different reasons. My grandfather became a Dodgers fan because he started following Jackie Robinson and fell in love with Jackie Robinson and what he stood for. So he became a Brooklyn Dodgers fan and then followed them out to LA. And my dad became a Dodgers fan because the Giants ended up trading Willie Mays to the Mets, which was blasphemous in his opinion. And he never forgave them for that. So he jumped ship, became a Dodgers fan. He also moved out to LA too. And so it kind of made sense. And both of them passed that down to me, and my love and passion and knowledge for baseball directly comes from them.
Please tell Mookie we miss him here in New England.
I bet you guys do. And each day I watch Mookie Betts, I think, what were the Red Sox thinking? And you look at, and sorry to kind of get sidetracked here for a little bit, but the return that the Red Sox got for Mookie Betts, I mean, Verdugo's in New York. Yep. Jeter Downs didn't end up panning out. He's not even on the team anymore. And I think you got a catcher, too.
Connor Wong, at least for now, the starting catcher, because you like the light-hitting catchers who can steal a base every once in a while.
Right. That's what you get a catcher for, right?
Yes.
That's the only reason you want a catcher for. So, yeah, that was a head-scratcher for me, for sure.
Yeah, we're still wondering about that here throughout the Northeast. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the broadcasting journey that you made. You always had acting in the back of your mind. Was any of that interest in broadcasting an attempt to sort of carve out some territory of your own that was away from, for lack of a better term, the family business?
Yes and no. I wasn't so much that I went the broadcasting route because I didn't want to go into acting or because I wanted to separate myself. I really did have a passion for it, and I developed a lot of great skills as a result. But I've always loved performing at any level, in any venue. I mean, I have a pretty extensive background in improv comedy. I did a lot of improv while I was in Houston. But as a broadcaster, I felt that I was playing a character on TV. I mean, they tell you in school, you know, to make it about, you know, bring yourself to it, obviously, bring your personality. But like when you're covering a triple murder, you're not necessarily going to be yourself, you know, like, you know, as a bystander, you might say things out loud to the people around you that you probably wouldn't want to air publicly. And so when you get on air, you have that kind of buttoned up type of feel. And so you have that style. So I always felt that I was playing this character. But then the parts of which that I loved the most about broadcast news were those kind of softball stories, like the Mother's Day flowers, you know, those kinds of stories, or, you know, saving a cat in a tree, or, you know, what's it like to be a beekeeper, inside the mind of a beekeeper, you know, how dangerous is it? You know, those types of fun stories, I felt like I could really open up my personality and really put a lot of my dry sense of humor into it, my writing into it. I also felt that way at KCAL when they gave me an opportunity to be a sports anchor, I was one of the anchors of Sports Central, which was our weekend highlight show. And I got to basically, you know, dive into these highlights and describe things in ways that only I could describe them. And that was a lot of fun for me to be able to write these highlights the way I wanted to and kind of show my personality that way. But ultimately, I felt that there were a lot of limitations to what I could do in broadcasting, and I didn't really want to be covering the day-to-day mundane, you know, stabbing, murder, fire, you know, housing market crash or whatever story was going on, because it's such a hit or miss. You know, you could get a string of just terrible, depressing stories and have a terrible week, or a string of great stories that you never really know. And I always felt that I wanted to perform more. I wanted to be an actor, and the things that I liked about broadcasting just weren't there as consistently as I wanted them to be. And so then I decided that once I was back here in LA, that I was kind of going to do both. And so I did both for a while. And eventually, as of last May, I was let go from KCAL News, and I was able to pursue acting full time. And I've been doing that ever since.
You're in the new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, right?
I am. Yeah. Episode 4. I got to do a little bit on that. And for me, that was a dream come true, because Curb Your Enthusiasm is one of my favorite shows of all time. Seinfeld is my favorite show of all time. So to be able to be around Larry David, Tracy Ullman, Jeff Garlin, and Susie, all four of those people were in the scene that I was in. So getting to watch them, these like titans, it was like, you know, to kind of create a sports analogy, it was like an all-star game. It was like the best of the best at their craft doing improv for one of the most successful shows of all time was just like a dream come true for me. And then to be in a scene with them was just the best thing ever. And definitely one of the coolest moments of my life.
Well, the new movie is called Love and Taxes. Watch for it. Hopefully we'll see it out there in theaters and streaming services going forward. It is a wonderful movie. You're so good in it. You've got great comic timing, such an engaging personality on screen. You bring Donald to life at so many different levels and so many depths. So it's been great to talk with you. We wish you luck with Love and Taxes and everything else in your career going forward. Thanks for being with us today, Jake.
Of course, Rich, anytime you want me on, I will gladly join you. I hope this season for the Red Sox is a lot better than last season. But I can't make any promises.
Connor Wong will lead us to the promised land. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you.
Take care. Jake Reiner with us here on Downtown. The film is Love and Taxes. It is 26 minutes after the hour. We'll take a break. Back with more right after this. Michael Toole at 207-307-7718. That's 207-307-7718. Office is located at 23 Water Street, Suite 405, Bangor, 04401. Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC.
Central Street Farmhouse, downtown Bangor, is
what
the
region. What do they sell?
Well, I was just about to say, but you interrupted me. Central Street Farmhouse, downtown.